Good evening. Welcome to our once a semester Dean's Dialogue, where we take up a controversial issue or an issue that's of going public concern. And the goal is to have an intellectual conversation on the issue, to model civil discourse and disagreement, to model intellectual engagement that's kind of not scripted by a syllabus, that sort of a thing. And we're excited to be doing that tonight on the topic of global climate change. And I'll introduce our guests in just a second. But I want to thank you for coming tonight and let you know that we'll be doing a couple of things that are typical of these dialogues. The panelists that I'll, as I said, introduce in a second, they will give about a five-minute overview on their perspective on global climate change. This is partly in response to a film that we screened last night. How many of you were there to see An Inconvenient Truth? Okay, good. How many of you have seen it? Most of you have? Okay. It's not so much a discussion of the film, but we'll bring in those issues, definitely. But it's a discussion of the hypothesis itself on global climate change. Each of the panelists will present for about 5 minutes, and then we'll have a bit of a dialogue. I've got some questions for them that I've received, some from our community and some from students. And then also, we'll give you a chance to ask questions. But what we'd like you to do is, during their comment time, we'd like you to listen carefully, but also on a sheet of paper, just jot down any questions you might have that you'd like me to ask the panelists. And that'll help us to kind of get through the questions a little more quickly that you have. We'll have the ushers will pick up those questions after the comment period. So in the first 15 minutes, if you have something you want to write down for the panelists, that's the time to do it. We'd love to have your questions, and we'd love to have the dialogue framed in part around the questions and observations and thoughts that the students have as well. I'm very excited about this panel. This issue of creation care, if you've read the book of Genesis, you know that God asked, in fact mandated, Adam and Eve to tend the garden in Genesis. And so tending the garden is in part one of the most basic things that we were to be about as humans in this created world. And so creation care stewardship, it's not been with us for a long time, although you can see evidence of it in St. Francis's thinking and other historic Christian figures. But in the past 20 years or so, more and more Christians have been thinking about how it is we are obligated to care for the creation. Later on this week, we're going to have some events on Thursday, oriented toward the design of our science building and design of our science building in a way that will better steward the creation, save energy, reduce costs, help to keep your tuition within a manageable range, and so on. But this is an important issue for us globally. It's an important issue for us in our campus and community. So with that, I'll introduce our panelists. Drew Budner. Drew, you can raise your hand so everybody knows who you are. Drew Budner's a chemist, and he has a very interesting research history studying ice cores, and so he has looked at the scientific evidence himself on the ground. He joined us here, is it just a year and a half ago? Yeah, it feels like you've been here for a really long time. He joined us here a year and a half ago in the chemistry department. We're so pleased to have him here at Whitworth, and we're pleased to have him here tonight. Carrie Brino, a green chemist in residence, somebody who's studying chemistry but studying, I hope I get this right, how to do chemistry in a way that's less harmful to the environment, in particular types of chemistry that are less harmful to the environment. And so she brings a wealth of knowledge and a passion for this issue herself that's born in part of her work as a scientist, but also out of her faith. Patrick Van Inwagen, also a scientist, but a political scientist, and member of the political science department. This is your fourth year?
Third year.
Okay, right. Third year here at Whitworth, and we're happy to have Patrick here. Patrick's research interests have been in the area of peacemaking and revolution, but he's also taken a keen interest, and in fact, the two of you collaborated on a project, Carrie and Patrick, on a project this Jan-term where students got to present, I think, isn't that right? And so on the issue of global climate change or things related to that. And so we're really pleased to have all of our panelists here, and right now what I'm going to do is let each of them take about 5 minutes. They know that I'm really strict on the time limit, and so and that just helps us to keep the dialogue going. So thank you very much, and thank you to our panelists.
Apparently, I get to start. So as Dr. Leroy said, I'm Drew Budner.
I spent about 6 years studying ice core and the chemistry of ice cores, not specifically on global warming issues, but on some paleo-environmental issues, recording major volcanic eruptions in ice cores. But in part of that work, we did spend some time looking at the actual data that has led to these long-term records of past climate. And if you see that all the data that has been presented over these thousands of, hundreds of thousands of years, all of that work actually is originated from ice cores in polar regions, either in Greenland or in Antarctica. And we see that using ice cores, we can get some fairly detailed records going back. The most recent ice core, which was about 3,000 meters long, gives us approximately 800,000 years worth of data. And from that, we can get a whole bunch, a variety of different data. We can get gases that are trapped in the in bubbles within the ice. We can also get some temperature data that you see a lot of, where you can, by looking at the different isotopes of oxygen, how that's in there, you can see that's related to the temperature, the time the snow fell. So these are the types of records that have been produced from ice cores. One of the things you will notice, that if you've ever been to Antarctica, which I have, yay for me, that it's cold, but it's also very dry. So at the South Pole, the average snowfall is about 10 inches a year. So that by the time you get back to about 800,000 years, then we're talking about snow accumulation that's less than a millimeter in thickness. So a lot of the time scales that we refer to when we talk about this evidence are fairly big. We have plus or minus maybe 1,000 years on those. So the big controversy, or the, I don't want to say controversy, the misconception is that we do see every time that we get an increase in temperature, we get an increase in CO2 levels. The question that is still unresolved is which happens first. Do we get an increase in temperature followed by an increase in CO2, or do we get an increase in CO2 followed by an increase in temperature? The relationship between those two is not in question. We do see, every time we see an increase in temperature, we see an increase in CO2, and every time we see an increase in CO2, we see an increase in temperature. Currently, the United States program is working to go through this last transition, an ice core. It's going to do a high-resolution ice core that will take this last transition where we come out of an ice age and into this current warming period to kind of answer those questions, which is occurring first. I don't think that really has any bearing on future projections, but it'll get us a better understanding of this climate system. I don't know how long I've gone. I'm just going to keep talking until somebody shuts me up. what was I going to say? Worldview. To me, the question of how to deal with CO2 levels is part of the worldview. But I think it's because if we look at the oil and coal reserves that we have available, we're talking maybe, and this is me just talking, I don't have the evidence, maybe 50 to 100 years worth of reserves left at current consumption. We know that every day we are rapidly increasing our consumption. So if we're talking about that short of time frame, I think it's imperative that we actually take the step to move to alternatives and actually look. It makes sense to me that if we want our economy to be strong and our scientific standing in the world to be strong, that we should be not following the rest of the world in these technologies, but actually leading it. So we would be actually leading the world into the next type of energy consumption. That's all I have.
So where I wanted to start was to give you an idea about the difference between climate and weather. Climate is a really long-term perspective. And that's one of the challenges when we talk about global climate change. We're not talking about your lifetime. We're talking about millions of years. And so when we look at the shifts that we may be seeing, sometimes it's hard to tell because we have data from the ice cores, but we also have data from land-based scientific observations, but many of those only go back 200 years. And if we think about the time scales on Earth and climate change, that is really a blink of the eye. And so that becomes one of the challenges. The other part of kind of looking at those is that it is very important to see the differences that are occurring. And our CO2 levels currently are higher than they have been before. We can show that by parts per million, by aerosol data. And what we need to ask ourselves is, does it matter? And that question cannot be answered completely, but we can see that it is causing an effect. As light gets into our atmosphere, it can get stopped by the clouds, or it can come down to Earth and be reflected back. When it's reflected back, it causes the molecules to vibrate. And when it vibrates, that just produces heat. So this is the global warming concept. And so it really matters how much reflective surface we have on Earth. Ice is going to be able to reflect light. Our sea instead takes in a lot more energy, and so more energy is stored on Earth rather than being reflected out so that it can be changed enough to radiate those molecules. And so as we look at the changes that I think we can scientifically prove, we need to look at some of the pictures of how the polar environments are changing. And there's a lot of documented evidence that the thickness of the ice in the North Pole is significantly changing. And some of the Greenland sheets are changing. I don't know that it's quite as extreme as some would say, but they definitely are changing. And we need to be aware that with those changes, we may throw Earth out of balance. We have an amazing capacity as humans, as individuals, to profoundly affect our environment and community. And that can be in many good ways, but that also can be in many hazardous ways. And so if we put a burden on the Earth system that it cannot naturally accommodate, and there is question about what can naturally be accommodated, then we should expect that there should be some global changes that are severely going to affect our lives. One of the results of climate change is that there's a projected sea level increase of, depending on the report, 7 to 23 feet based on melting ice. And this is maybe where my Christian worldview comes into play the most. I think that creation care is important, but creation care and thinking of the environment and tending the garden is only one small part of the picture. We are called to serve humanity. Jesus called us to take care of the poor and to work with all of our community. And the most vulnerable people on this earth are going to be those who are poor and those who are in areas where there are lack of resources to deal with the problems. If you imagine some of the natural disasters that we've had, tornadoes this last couple months, tornadoes or other natural disasters, it's hard to deal with the after effects of even those small problems. And so if we think about it on a large scale, like the flooding in over Christmas just a couple of years ago, those humanitarian needs call us to action and paying attention to what's happening and whether we are sending Earth out of balance.
Thank you. So I'm going to have my introductory statements be focused also on how does my faith fit into this, and what can my perspective as my professional discipline add to this in terms of being a political scientist. And I'll start where they ended in terms of talking about my faith, because my faith tells me that we should be concerned for the poor. We should be active agents for encouraging the systemic changes that address the needs of the poor, and that those are going to be, the poor are especially going to be the ones affected by climate change and larger scarcity issues. And so it doesn't seem to me that there's a whole lot of disagreement about whether or not we should help out people in need, and most Christians, I think, would agree with that. But I don't think that that's honestly enough either, knowing that we need to help other people out and that climate change could have an impact on especially the poor isn't enough. Morality in general usually isn't enough for people to change their behaviors. And that's where my political science discipline sort of starts to kick in. Yesterday was President's Day. I know we didn't have it off, but a lot of people didn't. They were celebrating George Washington and Abraham Lincoln's birthdays. And focus on Lincoln a little bit. He's oftentimes referred to as the great emancipator because of the Emancipation Proclamation and his role in the Civil War, freeing the slaves. When he ran for president, he was somebody who ran opposed to slavery, saying it's something that's morally wrong. I don't think anybody really questions whether or not he believed it was morally wrong. He was elected in 1860, but it wasn't until 1863 that he got around to the Emancipation Proclamation. So he knew that morally this was wrong and that there should be a change, but other things had to convince him that it was the right time to do that. I think that there's a similar reality with climate change issues, that we know that we should be helping the poor and helping people who are going to have to deal with climate change issues, but that's not enough. And so from my political science perspective, I see a lot of other reasons that hopefully can help us motivate to create some change. First off, there's national security issues. For the U.S., we're very reliant on foreign oil. And so a lot of our oil and a lot of the oil that's produced in the world comes from places that are either unstable or have problematic governments. And for national security reasons, we are better off if we can wean ourselves from that kind of dependency. Another reason would be that there's some real economic benefits that we could see by addressing climate change issues. Just as an aside, whether these climate change issues are the worst case scenario or they don't even pan out, we could still have the economic benefits. The same thing goes for the national security. The same thing actually goes for all of these reasons. Whether or not climate change is real and devastating or real and just problematic or real and doesn't really have much impact, there's a lot of things that we can do that will help us out and that can be a real benefit to us. One of those, again, is in terms of the economy, creating new jobs, developing new technologies, and also not just in terms of technologies, but low-skilled labor kinds of jobs have a real potential for some fairly significant growth just in doing conservation kinds of things in the U.S. And again, my faith comes in and saying we should be helping people find jobs that can pay a living wage and to help offset some of the economic costs. There are also issues in terms of scarcity, and that those issues of scarcity are more likely to affect the poor. Scarcity being in terms of, Drew mentioned coal and oil. The coal will have it for quite a while, unfortunately, but oil and other, and the bad effects of coal are also problematic. We can become more efficient in using these, but there's only so much to go around. And I'm not sure we've reached the point where we can say that our consumption is at the direct expense of somebody else, but if we haven't reached that point, we're really close, that our consuming this oil means that it's not available for other people, and those other people have a much lower standard of living than we do. I think there's also some broader issues that people oftentimes don't think of in terms of it would be a change could actually increase happiness. A lot of our the reasons that we have contributed to global warming are dealing with our overconsumption in a lot of ways. And if we can change some of that, then we spend less time working to buy stuff and more time playing with each other or talking with each other or engaging in things that a variety of surveys have showed. Those are the kinds of things that actually make you happy. More stuff doesn't tend to increase happiness. There's also some health benefits. Our lifestyle is not very healthy, and our lifestyle, again, is dependent on large consumption. And so driving a long distance to work, eating fast food, sitting and watching a TV to find out more products that you know that you don't have and that other people do have, and so you need to work harder. These kinds of things are unhealthy. And then the last thing is I think it can really promote international goodwill if the U.S. takes some significant stances towards addressing climate change issues. I think all of those, in addition to the moral issue, can be a way that we can create some progress in dealing with this issue. I think I'll turn back to you.
That's great. Thank you very much. Thanks to the panelists. We're ready for your questions. So if you have a question you'd like to ask the panel, I think the ushers are back there in the booth. But if you could pass it to these two center rows, that'd be great, and they'll collect them. So if you have a question, you can pass it over. Thanks. So you can pass your questions over, and everybody will know what Ruth asked, because I think we only got one. But let's start with the scientific evidence issue, because this whole question of debate, thank you. If there are any others, you can just bring them on up. This whole question that's being debated by the politicians and become the subject of campaign rhetoric and the subject of global rhetoric as well wouldn't exist if there wasn't some confusion on the one hand, or maybe real controversy about the scientific evidence itself. What I'd like you to do is to comment on, do you find the scientific evidence persuasive? And if so, how do you come to that conclusion that the science is so compelling such that we should respond, that government should respond, that business should change what it's doing, that our own individual habits should change, that I could finally persuade my wife to put those fluorescent bulbs in her favorite reading lamp, which she just doesn't want to do. But the evidence has to be compelling enough for us to act. And do you find it compelling, and what gets you there, intellectually speaking? So anyone can take that up.
Yeah, I'll start explaining some of the reason why there is probably a controversy. If you've ever read some of the scientific literature about global warming and the data, it's not easy to read. It's not terribly exciting. They use a lot of symbols, some of them you've probably never seen before. So that is probably one of the problems. But as scientists, I think we are trained not necessarily to state unequivocally what we know, but to point out what we don't know. I think our jobs are really to explore the unknown and what we don't know. So a lot of the evidence also not only comes with the evidence itself, but our uncertainty in that evidence. So I think because we are stating evidence with an uncertainty, it opens the possibility that people can exploit that uncertainty. But for me, if you look at the evidence, the uncertainty that the climate changes or the CO2 levels is maybe 0.1% that we're wrong. That's a small uncertainty, but the uncertainty does exist. I think taking the published data that has an uncertainty, to some people that would obviously promote the possibility that there is a controversy when there really isn't. All of the scientific evidence is pointing towards dramatic climate change.
Well, what I'm wondering, Drew, is as a scientist, when you evaluate the evidence, is the evidence sufficient such that you would personally engage in some different behaviors that might cost you more? that you would suggest that Whitworth engage in some behaviors that might cost it more in the short run, and that our government itself engage in some policy choices that might result in higher taxes or something like that in the short run. But really, that's what it comes down to, is the scientific evidence persuasive enough that it should force some decision making?
I would definitely say it is. But there is this link between our, as Carrie said, our time scales. You know, if you look at all the records from here, the evidence isn't as persuasive. If you look at the global time scale, then it is. I think that's something that we do have to change, is our idea that our lifetimes are fleeting, and it's really not us we're doing things for. It's our children, our grandchildren, their grandchildren. They're gonna face the consequences. I think we're seeing that our generation, or my generation, is seeing that more and more, and is probably more aware of that. So I would say that it is.
Okay. And the rest of you?
So I think one of the ways that science works is that we have an idea about what's going to happen, and then we collect data, and then we kind of analyze the data to see if it fit the hypothesis, and we say yes or no, and maybe we don't know exactly. And then we always, that uncertainty, it always creates a need to collect more data. And I think that's how the discussion of global warming has kind of evolved, in that, okay, well, we could see that the CO2 levels were rising. We started to collect ice core data. We started to collect temperature points. Just this year, we started to actually measure with numerous hundreds of water buoys some of the Atlantic current. We are sending up a satellite. One of the research teams in the U.S. is sending up a satellite to actually look at the entire globe and look at CO2 levels, and that way you can kind of see where the local sinks are, or where the CO2 is coming in and turning into something else, and where CO2 is coming out. And so you can kind of see a better accounting. So with each of those steps, each of those data points, we support the idea that global climate change is occurring, and that we need to take action, and that those actions can be more effective if we work as a community, if we work as a group, and so we have to work through our institutions to make it more than changing a light bulb.
My reaction is a political scientist again. I haven't read the scientific journals with the symbols that I've never seen. I depend on other people to give me that information in a digested form. But as a political scientist, I often want to look at who's benefiting from something. And so are certain scientists on the payroll of some agency, or who's funding it, and what interests might be at stake? And I think with global warming issues, I don't get a sense that there's whole lot of diabolical plan to sort of undermine people so that the rich can keep being rich. That, in fact, it seems to be the other way around, that if all of this pans out, or if it's true, then it's going to require more emphasis on the poor, more redistribution. And that's not something that people usually try and fund for research, or that's not something that you're trying to get some other vested interest to make more money out of. So I'm inclined to be much more open to that. And again, that's in part a reflection of my faith and what I think that we should be doing as individuals.
So one of the challenges, and I liked your articulation of the scientific process, uncertainty is built into scientific reasoning, right? There's never a point where a scientist says, absolutely 100%, we know this is true.
Never going to happen.
Right. Okay, good. So we start there, and we've got that uncertainty. And I love it. It's intellectual humility is what it's called. It's a good thing. It's one of the science's greatest gifts here. So we don't know for sure, and yet policymakers have to make decisions on the basis of uncertainty. And lots of us, we want answers. We want to know, is it true? Is it right? Is it wrong? And so we've got, in a way, a couple of incompatible discourses here. We've got a political discourse that has to make a decision about what we do, and we've got a scientific discourse that their job isn't to make decisions, their job is to understand what's happening. And they always are going to assert things with some degree of uncertainty. So we've got four options with that discourse. either the global warming hypothesis is correct, and we act, all right? And if that happens, we avert disaster, maybe, or at least minimize it or diminish it, right? Another option is that we don't act, and the global warming hypothesis is correct, all right? And if that happens, some of the disasters that you've alluded to, people in Bangladesh floating around, you know, trying to find a home, going somewhere else, mass exodus, refugees, economies being transformed overnight and so on, or maybe not overnight, but over the course of generations. That sounds pretty bad. Yeah, if the scientists are right and the politicians ignore it. Another option is that the global warming hypothesis is incorrect and we regulate and change all our behaviors. We spend a lot of money to do these things, but it turns out to be not correct. And so the big consequence there seems to be that we've maybe wasted lots of resources. And then the final option is that it's not correct and we don't do anything, and I don't know, we probably just keep going as we were. So that, in a way, is the dilemma. And I think if I've framed it properly, but that's also the big challenge for us. And so if we situate in contemporary politics, we've got the Bush administration over the past 7 years, which has said, you know, scientists are uncertain, and I don't want to have a policy program based on that, or that responds to data and information that seems to have a level of uncertainty, right? But Drew says it's like 0.1% uncertainty. So why would the Bush administration have said hold off based on 0.1%? What's your perspective on that as a scientist or as a political scientist? I think that's a big question out there for us.
Well, I'm not sure that I believe in that third option, where that if we're going to take action on global warming and then it's not true, that we haven't done something positive, or that it's going to cost us a lot of money without benefit. And I think this goes back to some of the things that you talked about, that there is a strong need for us to innovate and continue to grow as a technology and grow our technology sectors and to improve our global relations. And so the cost, a lot of companies are now going and looking and auditing their practices, and it's called sustainability, or it's called a green program. And what they're finding is as they make small changes, the reason they're doing this, one, it's PR. And some companies are just giving a nice facelift that it looks good. But most companies are really looking at how they go about things. And in doing that, they see an immediate economic return for the investment. And so I think that if we're stuck in our current modes of thinking, and I would argue that that's where we've been with the administration on science policy, that you can't see the benefits, you only see the cost.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I think I'd add to that in terms of the cost issue is most analyses of this have said it's going to cost something, and the debate is, are the benefits going to outweigh those costs? And so, unfortunately, a lot of it is because the climate change issues are potentially long, then trying to figure out what the costs are going to be are also fairly long. So what are the costs going to be over the next 100 years? And I've seen one estimate that was somewhere between $100 billion and $1 trillion be the sort of total costs over 100 years, and that's a lot of money. I mean, you look at it, and that's a lot. Just out of happenstance, if you get a chance to look at the Spokesman Review today, the bottom part of it, or the midway, is talking about climate change issues and how it's impacting local businesses. And then right below that is an issue that the federal government is asking for more money for the Air Force. And just out of irony, it's $100 billion is how much they're looking for to sort of revamp the Air Force. And so it's not that we don't have the money, but it is a lot of money, and it's got to come from somewhere. And I think that, especially early on in the administration, is a big part of why they didn't want to support it. Other personal things that I say, but
Well, why not? This is Dean's dialogue, so say it.
I think that the oil interests are a big part of the administration right now and a big part of their support, and they are going to lose in any kind of reduction in oil consumption.
Okay. Drew?
I think it's also not just a science issue, but I think it's our human nature that we don't like change. Right? I don't know how many times I've had a lamp that I don't use ever until the one day I turn it on and the light bulb's broken, so I replace the light bulb and then don't use it again for 3 months. Right? Just because the lamp's always been there, it should stay there. You know? I think that also is change is a large part, is unpopular. We like things the way we are, even though they could get better. We're always scared that they could get worse. So I think part of it is us not being comfortable with change, so it's not politically viable or advantageous to change, because the way we have works for me now, and I don't see why I have to change. I think so. It's a very personal thing as well. I think it's not just the science.
Okay, great, very tough issues, and we've got a lot of great questions here. I was really impressed with what you've come up with on the fly. The first one I wanted to ask you about, maybe the two scientists. From your scientific standpoint, what do you think about the people that say global warming is a hoax? Why would they say that? And what do you think about that?
So, I think one of the issues that you should, I don't know, from a scientific viewpoint, there are very few people that would disagree that the Earth is warming. Whether that trend is long enough, maybe they would disagree about, we have to wait a few more hundred years to actually say whether it's a new epoch. But very few of them disagree about the warming trend that we currently have. And so the real question is, what is the cause? And so is the cause water vapor in the air, which is also a greenhouse gas, or is that a feedback to the process? And that actually brings in a lot of the uncertainty that some of the initial climate models had. Some of them said, water vapor is going to be a positive feedback, or it's going to be a negative feedback. So that would affect how much change that we had in those predictions. And now, as we've gathered more evidence, we can see kind of where those predictions fit. And so I don't think the water vapor argument holds anymore. There's some new theories coming up about meteors being a trigger to global warming. I think that might stretch the realm of possibility. Do you have anything to add?
Well, yeah, I don't really have anything to add.
The hoax?
Yeah, I'm just trying to think of reason why I could think it would be a hoax. And from all my information I have, I don't see. I think, again, it goes back to the time scale issue. For me, since I've been working with ice cores in such long time scales, geological time scales for so long, I see the Earth as constantly changing. Right? So the fact that we are warming isn't a real surprise to me. But I think if we go back to the last 200 years, where our climate has been fairly stable, the fact that that could change, if you haven't seen a big change forever, I don't see in your lifetime, I think it would be a lot harder to understand that change. So I think it's, again, that time scale issue. And our understanding is that, it's always been cold in the winter and warm in the summer. I don't see why that would change. I don't think there's anything that we could do to change that. I could see how that would lead you to believe that this isn't occurring. But if you look at the geological time frames, the changes in temperature are huge, and the changes in landscapes are huge. So to me, I guess it's a little hard to
grasp.
Just to go off that, it's hard on a local level. When we did the Focus the Nation and the students presented, it was one of the coldest days in January. And so some of the questions I got back were, how could there possibly be global warming? I'm freezing. And so just our mental attitude about things.
Yeah, one data point there.
Yeah. That's, it's done.
That's interesting. Well, some of the criticism that the Gore film comes in for is that he has overstated the scientific consensus on the global warming hypothesis, that the scientific research, the literature, he describes as this kind of overwhelming consensus that everybody seems to have general agreement that on what you've described, the trends that you've described, and that human beings have had this effect on the change in the climate. And then he'll point to just a few sort of very small number of dissenting points of view. Just from your perspective as scientists working in a scientific community, in scientific networks, is there a scientific consensus? And do you know any scientists who are naysayers about this? I haven't met any yet, so I'm wondering if you have.
So I think the answer to this question would have varied when you ask it. So if you had asked this question 5 years ago, 10 years ago, then it would have not been as compelling. So if Gore had been saying this, he's been giving this speech for a really long time. If he had said that 10 years ago, I probably would have said he's just totally off base. But now I think there is kind of a consensus. There are a vocal minority of scientists in respected positions. The recently retired Virginia climatologist, scientist at Harvard, that have come up with these alternative theories. But they're really a handful of them versus the hundreds of scientists who do believe that the evidence is persuasive. I think you can see that in the IPCC reports, where 5 years ago they said this may be a problem. And then when they met this last year, they said it is a problem. We don't know how much, but it is a problem.
Yeah, in my experience, the controversy in the data isn't are we warming, but how warm are we going to get and what's the effect going to be. So I, as Carrie said earlier, I don't think there's any disagreement that we are warming. I think the disagreement comes on how is that going to affect us 10 years, 100 years from now, and what's the likely ramifications of that warming going to be.
And how fast is it going to happen?
That's great. This is really helpful. A lot of the questions the students sent forward had to do with what do we do? and there are a lot of similarities in that question. Maybe you could think for a second about what three things would you suggest we do either individually, nationally, globally, at Whitworth, whatever arena that you want to take. But what are the things that we can do to respond if indeed this science, I mean, if this is impending, if this is truly coming? And whoever wants to take that first can. So,
well, I'll start off at least at the sort of nationally or globally level. I think that the U.S. should, and whatever, it's not going to happen under this administration, but the next president should take a much more active stance on working with other countries throughout the world on whatever's following the Kyoto Protocol to limit greenhouse gases. I think that that is probably more likely to have an impact than anything else, primarily because it will set up the system so that people can benefit from it. Right now it's sort of up in the air. Are we going to have caps or are we not? Should we build this coal-fired powered plant or should we look at some alternative? The kinds of things that are going to have an impact on the costs are determined by whether or not there are caps on that. And so I think that's something that nationally and internationally really should be done. It'll also, I think, pay dividends in terms of restoring some of the U.S.'s perception in the world as not being such a sort of lone cowboy, that we're willing to work with other countries. I think take the sort of exact opposite, at the individual level, that if we realize more and more of the reasons for making a change, then we're more likely to make that change. Again, I don't think just knowing that it's the right thing to do is enough. But if we know it's the right thing to do and it'll make us a little healthier and we'll have more time for our friends and that'll influence some lifestyle choices, then we're more likely to stop consuming so much. And I think that's probably the biggest thing that people can do as individuals is not consume so much, do things as opposed to buy things. I think that that's That's the first and biggest thing that individuals can do.
I think the largest challenge when you think of a global problem is that there's no way that we can deal with this. And so I want to give you an example of a problem that we have worked on. Chlorofluorocarbons used to be propellants in lots of different products, in spray foams and just lots of products that came out as an aerosol or a spray. And in that case, the U.S. led changes, and then Europe followed, and we came up with a global policy that we should limit the CFCs. And the reason why we did that was because there was a large ozone hole, and that ozone hole is seasonally dependent, but the chlorofluorocarbons were dramatically affecting the size of that ozone hole. And many people said, this is much too big of a problem for us to tackle. And that it's just going to get bigger, and we should start thinking about what we're going to do when we're all having skin cancer. And instead, we decided to get together as a community and make policy to change our processes. And we were able to easily make substitutions. Did it require some transition time? Yes. Did it require some costs? Yes. But it also required innovation. And then on a personal level, you think, okay, I want to save some energy. I want to save some things. So you're thinking, okay, well, I'll turn off the lights. I'll put a power strip on my computer. I'll try and eat local food. Those are things that maybe you're thinking about as a college student, but I want to encourage you that you can do much more. You can really influence policy at Whitworth. If there were a group of students who were interested in getting together and running our boilers on campus off of biodiesel that came from Saga, you know what? There are people around this campus who would support that. Or if you have creative ideas, you want to be part of a community garden so we can have local food like the Deeds for Trees is talking about after this in the hub. Those are the things that are going to make a bigger impact, a visible impact, and that we should try and think creatively about what we're going to do to respond.
I just took all the good stuff. I would probably just reemphasize that is that the best thing that we can do is become informed. Read, watch the news. I know that's not fun, but it's a good idea occasionally. And get involved. Listen to people's opinions, especially those you don't agree with. I think you probably learn more from disagreement than you would do from agreement. So get involved, learn, talk to people, yell at people if you have to. I think that's all good things, and that would be the only thing that I would add.
Okay. Just don't yell at me. Yeah. No. Let's take Whitworth. We're gonna go for just a few more minutes, but let's take Whitworth as an example. One of the things that we'll be doing later this week is we're going to have an eco-charrette over the lunchtime on Thursday from 11:30 to 1. If you want to come, students are invited, faculty, staff. It's kind of a first-come, first-served lunch. And we're going to be talking about how we can design this new science building in a sustainable way. It's going to be a very large building, 60,000 square feet, about 50% larger than this building. And so the heating and lighting and all the costs associated with that building are going to be quite high anyway because it's a science building that requires a lot of ventilation. But we're going to be trying to think and learn how we can design this building in a more sustainable way. What other things, as you sit here at Whitworth, what other things should we be considering, should we be doing? And it's easy to point the fingers. I mean, you know, I drive past the administration building where my offices are, and I think, oh, man, a light's on up there. I hope somebody's not working. But if they aren't working, I hope that light gets turned off. So we do it. I drive past the residence halls and see the windows open in January because the heat, you know, is not working in the room or whatever, or working too much. But what kinds of things should we tackle first if this is a serious issue that we want to take seriously? What are the things that you're seeing that we're not necessarily doing that we could do better at?
Paper. We consume a lot of paper. and we waste a lot of paper. Mm. And it takes energy, it takes chemicals, it takes lots of things to bleach and make that nice paper. And so if you can ask your professor whether they mind getting an electronic copy of your paper, or whether you can take notes or do something with technology that would reduce your reliance on paper, or actually even to think about whether you need to actually print that 50-page document. Are you really going to read it? Just paying attention to paper would be a way that you can definitely start paying attention to yourself and not looking for others.
Mm-hmm. I would say one thing, and I don't know this. I haven't seen how much we spend on heating, but just knowing that we're in the Northwest and that we have a lot of buildings, heat is where most of our energy is going. That's where most of our energy is going towards. A lot of the buildings aren't air-conditioned, or they don't have a whole lot of people in the summer, so that's not a big issue for us like it is in other parts of the country. And so I would say one thing that Whitworth could probably do, and this is kind of boring, is to do upgrade insulation and have more better windows. And this is, again, it's not anything that's all that spectacular, but it's the kind of thing that if a lot of institutions are doing this, there'll be more demand for, it's a relatively low-skilled job that you're providing, and renovating older buildings to make them more energy efficient is probably the biggest thing that I would think larger institutions especially can do, because that's where most of their energy is going, and we're not going to give up heat. We need to have a certain level there, so we need to think of ways to be more efficient about that. And we're not going to tear down the buildings, because that's also not necessarily a good idea, and just build everything up to new standards. We have to do something with the old buildings. And so it's doing renovations for those older buildings. And I know that that is somewhat costly. I also know that it does eventually pay, but they're really long-term kinds of costs.
My idea is probably not a very popular one, and that is parking. I know everybody wants their parking spot as close as they can. I disagree with that. If your car's parked across campus, you're much less likely to use it to go someplace you don't need to go anyway. You're less likely to drive across campus to park in front of the other building. So that is my, just walk, I think. If we realize that walking across campus isn't that bad, then we'll realize that walking from our apartment, which is four blocks away, isn't that bad, which then we'll realize that walking 10 blocks isn't that bad, and we will become healthier and cut down on our usage of gas.
That's great. We'll put Drew on the parking committee. And if you come to my office, you'll see that I've given up heat for Lent, it seems. So it's very cold in there. Well, I want to thank our panelists for a really stimulating evening. It's been wonderful to hear what you've had to say, and I've learned a lot, so thank you very much. I want to just remind you that this Thursday we will be engaging in this design process. You feel free to come. It's in Hub A, B, and C, 11:30 to 1. The other thing I wanted to let you know is that Lindy Scott, a professor of modern languages who's here, he has come most recently from Wheaton College, where he was involved in editing a monograph entitled, that's a book, entitled Christians, The Care of Creation and Global Climate Change, and it's Christian reflections on this theme that we've been covering tonight. It's a publication by Pickwick Press, and he has some extra flyers. Linda, you want to raise your hand so everybody knows if you're interested in this book. So thank you very much, and have a great evening. Bye-bye.